This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll learn how an 800-year-old document is still having an impact on our civil liberties.
Michael Smith and I went over to a nearby location to see an actual copy of the Magna Carta from the year 1215. It's one of the key documents that we cited in the Guantanamo cases.
Stay with us.
Michael, I'm going to say bon voyage to you. You're leaving Christmas Day for Gaza to go on the Gaza Freedom March with your wife and your two children. And I understand there's a big problem now that the Egyptian Foreign Ministry has said they're closing the border on the pretext of tension on the border. And the 1,300 delegates from all over the world who are going there to join up with the Palestinians to break the siege are now told you're not going to get in. What's your thought about it? What can we do about it?
Well, we hope it's just the Egyptians acting as usual, or the Egyptians acting as usual at the behest of the Israelis, or some combination of the two.
And or Americans.
And or Americans. This is not abnormal for what happens when people want to visit Gaza and delegations want to visit Gaza. The Egyptians start to say, we're not going to let anybody in. What happens then is delegations then go near as the border they can get. They negotiate and eventually have mostly gotten in, not always. Now, of course, this could be exceptional because this is 1,350 people trying to draw national attention, worldwide attention, to the Gaza siege or Gaza blockade that is really killing people as we speak. And so the question is now, will we be going to Cairo? We are, yes. And when we take the bus across the desert to the Rafah entrance on the Egyptian side, will we actually get in? And as I sit here and talk to you, Michael, I have no idea, to be honest.
No, I can make a suggestion to all of our listeners on how to help Michael, the family, and everybody else get across that border. Get a pencil. You can help us by calling the Egyptian embassy. I'm going to give you their phone number and the name of the person to call. You're going to call Omar Youssef, Youssef, Omar Youssef at 202-895-5400. I'll repeat, Omar Youssef, 202-895-5400. Call him and tell him, let those people in. They're bringing medical aid, school supplies, winter jackets for the children. And by not allowing the Gaza Freedom Marchers in, it's really an international disgrace.
Yes, it is. And it's really sad to me because I think the regular people in Egypt, the people on the ground in Egypt, are really upset over the treatment of Palestinians in Gaza and would want this march to go through. So this is a governmental decision at some level. And as you said, Michael, we don't know what it is, whether it's an American decision, an Israeli decision, or some combination of the Egyptians, Israelis, and the Americans. But I can just stress how important it is to start putting pressure on the Egyptians to open the Rafah border entrance to the 1,350 people coming there for the Gaza Freedom March.
It's an amazing thing. It's never happened before that people from all over the world gather to go on a demonstration like this. It's unprecedented. You can help by calling Omar Youssef at 202-895-5400. Go to the website GazaFreedomMarch.org/solidarity. We'll link it with LawAndDisorder.org. Good luck, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael Ratner and me, Michael Smith, are standing in front of 54 Pearl Street, France's Tavern, about to climb up two flights of stairs to visit the exhibit on Magna Carta. It's going to be at the museum till December 15th. And this document, quite extraordinary, it's nearly 800 years old. It was originally drafted in England and traveled here from the Lincoln Cathedral the first time for the 1939 World's Fair. In January of 2008, we interviewed author Peter Linebaugh on his book, The Magna Carta Manifesto. The book is a sweeping history of the Magna Carta as a long-standing restraint against tyranny, the support of trial by jury and due process of law, the prohibition of torture, and the rights of habeas corpus. Peter Linebaugh worked to construct the original history of the Great Charter and its little-known companion, the Charter of the Forest, which was created to protect the rights of the common people. We will hear excerpts from that interview as well. We're pleased now to talk with the curator and educational director of Francis Tavern. We're pleased now to be able to speak with the curator and educational director of Francis Tavern, Jennifer Patton, and the communications director of Francis Tavern, Tony Wellman.
We're here at Francis Tavern, and we came down for a special exhibition they're having of the Magna Carta. And we're here with two of the people from the Francis Tavern, Tony Wellman and Jennifer Patton. And we're going to talk a little bit about the significance of the Magna Carta and why it is here. So let's start, Tony. We're standing near a case with a document that's some 800 years old. What is it?
Well, first of all, I'm going to lead off by saying that I know that one or both of you are constitutional law scholars. Which one of you is that?
Michael Ratner is a human rights lawyer. He's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which has been causing all the constitutional trouble for the
and
government.
And, of course, we depended on the Magna Carta for our arguments that the people at Guantanamo should have a right to habeas corpus. It was actually the critical document.
So I'm sure we're going to be learning from you today.
We're interested in how it came to be that you got this sheepskin document from the year 1215. We understand there's only four of them left in the world. And here we are standing in the shadows of Wall Street in this old, old tavern with wood beam ceilings, kind of in the dark because the light would hurt the document. And we want to know, how did it come about that you got this thing?
Well, that's true. We should mention the document is here until December 15th. The exhibit will continue after that, but the original document has to be returned and go back into conservation darkness. The exhibit goes back, the planning's a couple of years, Jennifer, doesn't it?
Right, a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I would say spring of 2007. Shortly after I came on as education director, it was sort of an idea that a place that used to be an arena of talking about rights and liberties of the colonists revolting against the British, perhaps that there could be a tie-in with a document proclaiming such rights for the English people, even before the New World was known of. So that's how it started, and it took a very long time to just get everything in place and sign the contracts with Lincoln Cathedral and get a whole new security system and heating and air conditioning system and fire suppression system installed, and hoping that this will really sort of boost the appearance of Francis Tavern after Magna Carta leaves.
Well, Jennifer, tell us about the significance of Francis Tavern.
Oh, absolutely. The building, where it is, was originally built as a house by the Delancey family in 1719. So there's been a lot of changes to the building, restorations throughout the centuries, but that does make it the oldest surviving building in Manhattan.
As a matter of fact, on the first landfill in Manhattan. We're standing on the first landfill in Manhattan.
Right, first landfill. Yeah.
The water originally went up to Pearl Street, is that right?
Right.
And so this would have been in the water, right?
It would have been. So the water's edge was right on the sidewalk and in front of the building.
The Van Cortlandts actually purchased it as a water lot before they even created land on it, and then filled it in with landfill, and then it was built in 1719, the house was.
So this is the first Battery Park City of Manhattan.
Right, yes, the same idea, exactly. But once the building was completed, this was no longer a residential area for the upper class. The Delanceys were a very rich merchant family. So right after it was finished, they decided to live elsewhere. Right away, they started leasing it out to different businesses. It was leased out to Henry Holt, who ran it as a dance studio. And then in 1762, Sam Francis purchased the building for about £2,000. And then he opened it as Francis Tavern, or really known as the Queen's Head Tavern, or the Sign of Queen Charlotte in 1762.
Well, we're standing right over an amazing case with, obviously, even more significantly, an amazing document within. This is the 1215 Magna Carta. As you said, it's one of four in existence. They're originally, I forget if we mentioned it, originally about 41 were produced. All of them bore the king's signature, which was in the form of the royal seal.
By produced, of course, we mean hand-copied in Latin, which is what it's written in.
Latin was the language of education and communications in those days. And, of course, that was the only means to spread news. There was no mass media. There was no newspaper. There wasn't even paper. This is, in fact, on sheepskin. Paper didn't arrive until the early 1300s in England.
I didn't even know that.
So this is limed sheepskin, we are told. This was delivered to Lincolnshire in Lincoln Cathedral in June of 1215 and has remained there since then.
You mean this came from England?
Yes, this is on loan from...
Oh, I didn't realize
that.
Yes. I thought we had our own copy in the United States.
No, we have to send it back, I'm afraid.
Well, what we think of in terms of the American Magna Carta is usually what people think of is at the National Archives. That's a 1297 Magna Carta. It's a later version. It's residing there indefinitely by a private owner.
So I had no idea. This is the actual 1215.
This is the first version.
Oh, my. I knew there were other versions.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know how lawyers are. They like to revise things.
This is thrilling. Well, let's talk about the circumstances under which the king was forced, because he didn't want to, was forced to put his royal seal on this piece of sheepskin.
There were a number of mounting disagreements between the king and his noblemen that had taken place, largely connected to the war with France and all of the expenses which were incurred on that. As often, taxes are at the basis of a lot of revolutions, and this was one of them. And the barons felt they were being unjustly taxed. But this really was the culmination of a lot of other arguments and unpleasant disagreements they'd had for years. So there are many other things besides just taxation issues represented in here.
Before you go on to some of the substance, which I'm very interested in, can you just give our listeners a description of the document? Because it's not as if, you know, it's not like something that's simple to read. It's not many pages. Just a description.
Sure. Well, as we look in the case, first of all, we're in a fairly darkened room because for an 800-year-old document to continue for another 800 years, we have to protect it from harsh conditions, light being one of them. Light would certainly fade this out. So the room is no more than 50 lumens. The case in which it sets is atmospherically controlled for the perfect amount of moisture, light. Of course, there are all kinds of security measures connected with it as well. So as we look at it, it's resting loosely in this case. It's all in Latin, so I can't help you with reading it word for word. We do have some translations, by the way, we will show you that we can discuss. And you see some interesting portions in there, encompassing everything from taxation issues, property issues, women's issues, trial by one's peers issues. All of those things were contained in here. Just to further to describe it, it's about 17-inch square, very plain, all written in very, very tiny, tiny script by some monk 800 years ago, one of 41, as we said, which were produced and then distributed throughout the realm to spread the word that the king had finally agreed to with some of these key issues. At the bottom, you'll see three holes, and those were originally to affix a ribbon to which the king's seal was attached. That's the way the king signed off in those days.
There's been a historical controversy over the document, and in the 19th century, many scholars said, well, this was a thoroughly reactionary document because it kind of ensconced the rule of these feudal barons. But I don't really agree with that, because I think it was kind of the beginning of an unfolding of democracy, and I wondered what you two thought of that interpretation of it.
Michael, I think that's a great point for us to jump off and discuss. Basically, you're right to take the long view. It was a beginning. It was a start. Like many things historically, rights, privileges, property all start with a select few, and then gradually things become democratized over time. And I think that's what this exhibit shows, is that the spread of freedom and rights started with a select few, and of course you can't hold an idea like that back. And it found its way right to our shores here in the United States, in America, the American Revolution, and that's very much what this whole exhibit is about, which goes far beyond just the Magna Carta alone.
I will say it's an amazing shape for 800-year-old document. I'm really shocked. Where was it kept for the 800 years, and then we'll go upstairs?
Tell them about what the Dean of Lincoln Cathedral said is the secret to true conservation.
Is losing it for 600 years.
Really?
Yes, yes. They had no idea where it was. They didn't even realize, you know, that they still had it until about 200 years ago. Yeah, so, you know, keeping something in a drawer and then forgetting about it is really the best way to go.
Before we go upstairs, I want to take one look over at the wall when you come in. There's Article 39 from the Magna Carta is up on the wall, and that's very important in my work, and it has been very important, certainly.
Sure.
Right, the key is Magna Carta, and it has some of the English, mm-hmm. Article 39, which says that no free man shall be taken or imprisoned except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. Now, can you tell us what
I think I should be asking you about that, but to me, that has several things within it. Just as a layman, it's talking about judgment by your peers, a trial by jury, but isn't it talking about due process as well?
Yes, it's due process, it's habeas corpus, and if you read the part, there's a couple of words left out, but they talk about mistreatment, I think, or something like that in the clause itself, which goes to the original prohibition on torture comes through Article 39. It's the key foundation, really, in some ways, of certain parts of our U.S. Constitution, really. The Fourth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, and the Fourteenth Amendment.
Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth. It also says no taxation without consent. We all know that from the American Revolution. It says punishment appropriate to the crime, protection from prosecution without evidence.
Amazing.
And then, again, the henceforth no bailiff shall put anyone on trial by his own unsupported allegation without bringing credible witnesses to the charge.
I'll tell this last story. When we won a case in the Supreme Court in 2004, it's called Razul v. Bush, and it was the case that said that the people at Guantanamo had the right to the writ of habeas corpus. They actually cited the Magna Carta, and they said, when King John at Runnymede in 1215 was forced to sign the Magna Carta, we have since that time been against executive detention. It's anathema to this country, and it comes straight from there.
It's interesting and how things are the same and don't change. Le plus de chance, plus de même chose. Wasn't it true that after the king signed this document, in fact, King John did not adhere to it immediately? Is that true?
Right. Well, I wasn't there, but
you don't look a day over 750.
Yeah. But I do feel that when King John affixed his seal to this document, he had no intention of having it living for very long or existing for very long.
Just
basically,
an expedient move to,
right. I mean, at this point, he had been with, you know, obviously this is with the Catholic Church and with the royal family and whatnot. There were ups and downs. This was a time when he was really working with the Pope, and he asked the Pope shortly after he signed the document to have the Pope claim it void and nullify it completely. So then once the Pope did that, basically it was almost killed before it was even, you know, put into effect for the country. And consequently, within the next year, the barons went to war with the king. He was basically held up in London, being surrounded by the barons' forces, and then died with a slew of diseases. And then his nephew was given the throne, and with his the different people that were assisting with this 10-year-old boy who is now the king, Henry III, they declared a new Magna Carta in 1217, and that's the one that lived on. So.
But it's like once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put him back in.
Right.
1215, the genie came out of the bottle. No, get put him back in again.
We're on the opposite wall from number 39, and we have the Charter of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, and then we have the Virginia Charter. What's the significance of those?
Well, basically we have a few examples of colonial charters that carry on the idea of Magna Carta. And once again, writing down in law different ideas of liberty, rights to property. The Virginia Charter basically deals with that, of rights to property. You know, the New World opens up all this land that everybody wants to have a piece of. And making sure, the Virginia Charter is actually quite lengthy, and most of it talks about what you can't do, but it definitely takes a point to say what people have rights to, and the rights to have their own property and not have it taken away for various reasons. The Charter of Rhode Island and the Providence Plantations, it definitely makes a point to speak about matters of religion. Some may contest that the history of Rhode Island sort of deviates from that idea, but it's still right when it was begun in 1663 that they had this idea of everyone had the right to practice their own religion. I think what's nice about showing just these various examples is to just sort of show the intentions behind establishing new communities, new colonies in this whole continent that they didn't even know existed or how large it was, and various intentions, whether it is to own property, have rights to religion, how to spread their own faith, and to protect the rights of others, which I think is best exemplified in the Flushing Remonstrance.
What's the Flushing Remonstrance?
Oh, the Flushing Remonstrance.
What's the Flushing Remonstrance, you ask?
actually right now at the Queen's Library. Is that okay? There's a beautiful exhibit right now talking about the Flushing Remonstrance. Basically, we all know, well, most people should know, about before New York was New York, it was New Amsterdam, established by the Dutch in 1624. When Peter Stuyvesant came in 1657, all of New Amsterdam was just sort of in disarray. There was no law. People were able to steal from each other. They were trying to make as money, and so they were trying to get as many people over here as they could, but there was very much rule to the land. Peter Stuyvesant, he established hospitals, schools, but also made it by law that you had to go to the Dutch Reformed Church, kind of exceeding different ideas of government or what a director should be doing. He was definitely very anti-Semitic, and he also was very against Quakers practicing their faith. If you look at 17th century Quaker beliefs, a lot of it goes against what we think of how you respect authority. You don't call anybody by doctor or sir or governor. Everybody's a brother and sister. You don't remove your hat in front of somebody of authority. Different things that we think of common rules of social respect is not what they would have practiced in the 17th century. So Peter sees this as a slap in the face, along with other ideas of one, he didn't want other people in New Amsterdam to continue practicing these beliefs or spreading these ideas.
To be different from us? How dare you be different from us?
So what he does is he has an ordinance outlawing the practice of Quaker faith. He imprisons some of the preachers of this. The Queen's Library, once again, has a beautiful story that goes along with it. But basically, the people of Flushing, which we know as Flushing, Queens, where the Mets are today.
Where the number 7 train goes.
Right. They sign a petition and saying that everyone is allowed to have his or her own belief, that the law of love, peace, and liberty extends to Jews, Turks, and Egyptians, as they are all considered sons of Adam. I mean, this is just a profound statement. Peter,
to this day.
Right, exactly. Peter Stuyvesant, didn't pay it any mind. He said, whatever, I'm going to keep on doing my thing. They take their petition to the authorities of Amsterdam. And so basically they go to his bosses and say he's exceeding his limits of being director of New Amsterdam. So it's from the authorities of Amsterdam that they are saying that he had to remove the ordinance. So consequently he does.
Well, because New Amsterdam then reflected old Amsterdam in Europe, because it was a very prosperous commercial center. And just so everybody could get along and trade, there was a certain amount of liberty extended to Jews and Muslims and Christians. And that's what then becomes reflected here in Flushing, New York.
Right, exactly. And I think the most beautiful thing of the story is the people who wrote the Remonstrance were not Quakers. They're Christians practicing their own Christian faith, but they saw others being persecuted and they stood up for another person's rights. And I think that's really the most touching part of the story.
Okay, now we've just walked into another room at the Francis Tavern Museum. Again, we're with Tony Wellman and Jennifer Patton, and we're now standing in front of what looks like the Declaration of Independence. What is it?
Well, it not only looks like it, it is an exact copy of it. If what we understand to be true is true, this is one of only two copies in existence of this document. It was made in the early 1840s, I believe, by a process called the anastatic process. And without getting into too many details, what it basically was is a process by the use of fats and acids, and direct contact with the original document created a facsimile copy. And we are told that one of the reasons the original handwritten one in Washington is in such poor condition is because of the production of this anastatic copy. It literally sucked the ink out of it.
Right. It's almost like when I started law practice, we had to put mimeograph ink on the original.
So, I mean, this alone could be a centerpiece of an exhibit here, because it's only one of two. We know the other one is supposedly, I believe, is in the archives in Philadelphia in Independence Hall.
It's thrilling to be in front of this replica of the Declaration of Independence. I'm 5 feet away, and I can still read John Hancock's signature.
You can read it better than on the original if you go to Washington, I'm told. The collector who has loaned this to us found it, I believe, in a flea market about 20 years ago. He thought it was just a nice, pretty 19th century copy. And it was only till a few years ago that he noticed in the bottom left corner, if you look closely, you'll see it says anastatic facsimile. And he researched it, found out what it was, found out that there's one in Philadelphia's Independence Hall, and then found the whole history of this thing. And it turns out that it is an exact copy. It's the same size. The fold marks of the original are here. Everything is reproduced exactly as the original. It was even in a frame supposedly constructed by timber, which came from part of Independence Hall when it was being redone back in the 1970s.
That's great. We want to remind our listeners, we're here with Tony Wellman and Jennifer Patton at the historic Francis Tavern. It's historic because this was the place where, at the conclusion of the American War for Independence, George Washington bid farewell to his officers. It's still a going concern, and it has this fabulous exhibit, really about the unfolding of individual liberty and freedom. Starting with the Magna Carta, we're now in front of the Declaration of Independence, and all sorts of documents in between.
What more do you want? Actually, this is truly a revolutionary museum. It is the only museum in Manhattan dedicated to the American Revolution, Francis Tavern Museum. Correct. And this is wonderful here. Emma Lazarus's notebook from 1883 with one of the earliest copies in her own hand of the New Colossus, which
and,
of course...
And the New Colossus is?
Is, of course, the poem which you will find inscribed in the base of the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. And she, it says here, written in aid of Bartholdi's pedestal fund. Bartholdi, of course, being the sculptor of the statue, and they were trying to raise money in 1883 for the pedestal before we could get the statue over here. So she wrote that for it, and you stand here 2 feet away from something she set her own hand to, writing that amazing poem. It's just amazing.
If you wander over a little bit to the left, mm-hmm. quite literally and figuratively.
Jennifer, why don't you tell us about this one?
We're standing in front of the early printing of the Bill of Rights. Jennifer, what's your reason for including the Bill of Rights here?
Oh, well, I would definitely say that the Bill of Rights is the one American document and milestone that goes hand in hand with Magna Carta. And Victoria Hughes, which is the president of the Bill of Rights Institute, she states that 5 of the amendments from Bill of Rights comes directly from ideas of the Magna Carta.
We can guess with some of them. The Fourth
right.
Amendment, unreasonable searches
right.
and seizures,
mm-hmm.
the Fifth Amendment, right to due process, Sixth Amendment, right to jury trial. Now, what other ones can we think? Oh, the cruel,
well,
unusual,
the main one is
cruel
the
and unusual punishment,
right. yeah.
but
uh-huh.
that would be 4. And then there must be a 5th, but that's okay. Yeah.
But
right.
the main one that people remember is the First Amendment.
Amendment. Exactly.
And the story behind the Bill of Rights is that the people who made the American Revolution were still vigilant and active, and they had to write a new constitution, and the constitution wasn't that acceptable. And it wasn't acceptable to these armed farmers and small tradesmen and so on, because it lacked a Bill of Rights. So the Bill of Rights was found to be necessary in order to get the Constitution approved by the various states.
But it is amazing that 5 come directly out of the Magna Carta.
Right.
That's great.
You
yeah.
can't stuff the genie back in the bottle.
No.
Popped out in 1215.
People try.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out my show, Down Home Radio, at downhomeradioshow.com.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to the people at Francis Tavern who were successful in bringing the Magna Carta to New York. In the Magna Carta, we talked about Article 39, which is really the fundamental rights to trial, jury, habeas corpus, and all that. But there were other things that you mentioned that in studying with my son many years ago that we looked at, which there was a right, there's a term called Estover or something like that. Are you familiar with it?
I don't recall that one.
Is that a hormone?
It's the rights to, like, take things out of the forest or something.
Something like that. A very interesting thing about middle-aged England is this idea of the royal forest. When we think of the royal forest, at least when I first thought of it, I was thinking of, you know, Nottingham Forest and Robin Hood and all these different things. But it's more than a preserve of what we would think. It's land that is claimed by the king. You can't do anything in this land without the king's approval, whether it be you fish from it, if you kill game there, if you live there, if you farm there,
take
anything from there. So basically, pre-Magna Carta, I think it was called, the Doomsday Book or Box?
There is that one, the Doomsday Book or Domesday Book, whatever. It was a record of every single land parcel in England that was taken down and what tax was owed. That's what I recall from school.
So what happened is it was, in terms of the royalty, pre-King John, they realized that there may be people, citizens of England, that are living in the royal forest and taking things from it and not paying any sort of, basically you would be fined if you did something like this. So they went around all the lands of England and made record of anybody who happened to be doing that. And so having that on record, then people were fined, jailed, whatnot, for any sort of wrongdoings they were doing with this. So when King John, after his wars with France and needing to have an increase in taxes, he expanded his royal forest, basically claiming other lands that people were already living on, getting food from, having their farms and whatnot. He claimed that as royal forest, and then consequently they were fined for living in the royal forest. That's also, I have to look through my quick reference guide.
The disforested line.
Right.
It's
48.
But also, it's Article 48. Chapter 48, right.
Right. The reason why the Magna Carta is called the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, is to differentiate itself from a charter that had to specifically deal with the royal forest. There was a shorter charter that was written for that, and the only reason it was Magna Carta was originally called the Charter of Liberties, but then it had to just show that it was different from the shorter charter that had to do with just the forest itself.
In the original Magna Carta that you looked at, there are a couple of clauses about the forest.
Right.
It's Articles 48 and 47, which is what you've been really addressing about deforestation or whatever, is having the lands go back to the public, really. But then there was a separate charter eventually, and I'm not sure eventually or at the same time, called the Charter of the Forest, which is the one you're referring to, which must have either pulled those clauses out or kept this as a separate one. And, you know, it's becoming a very important contemporary charter now because people look at it as what they call the Charter of the Commons, the idea that certain property, and they're trying to take it forward today, is looked at as common property of people.
Creative Commons for copyright issues?
Well, that would be one. Yeah. Right, that would be actually one use of it. Another one might be oil wealth, might be another to put into a resource. But it's not really always resource. It's copyright and all that. So the Magna Carta is having a contemporary rejuvenation, really, or the Magna Carta clauses and the forest of the charter because of this idea
that
there's a commons.
Piece all of sheepskin we were just looking at.
I mean, I don't know if you have the clauses there.
Yes, I do. I have it. And I actually quoted it because it was one of the...
You might want to read what it says.
Sure.
It has some archaic language in there, but it's...
We will not be reading it in Latin. Jennifer's translation.
Yeah, this is an English translation. Clause 47, all forests that have been made forest in our time shall be immediately disafforested and to be it done with riverbanks that have been made preserves by us in our time.
And this forest that does not mean cut down. It means that they're to be taken out of the king's control, really.
Right.
That's really nice that you have that in there, because that's important.
If we can do this to the forest, what can we do about Goldman Sachs?
It's hard to wrest powers from monarchs. They don't want to give it up. History is a big power play. When we first started talking about the nature of this document and how well it only ceded power to these barons and not the people, but you really have to take a wider view on it. I mean, in those days, the common people, serfs and so on, were maybe not seen quite so much as people who had interests, as it were. And of course, as time passes, what once belonged to one man then belongs to a few men, then belongs to more men and women, et cetera, as history passes. The democratization of power.
I think that's right. And in fact, it was picked up in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I don't know if you remember this great scene in there. Arthur, I am Arthur, king of the Britons. Woman, king of who? Arthur, the Britons. Woman, who are the Britons? Arthur, we all are. We are all Britons. I am your king. Woman, I didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
An autonomous collective.
And that's the famous, thing that refers to really this whole idea.
I think that's where eventually Turner said, "Be quiet, bloody peasant." And he said, "Oh, that's what a giveaway!
I remember, I know it very well from my children seeing it all the time.
But it is important to your point, because some people, when they come in, if they just look at it and say, "Well, this was just granting power to a lot of rich white men," then you're only seeing it within the context of that immediate moment in history, and not the bigger message that was behind it.
Our old friend and hero, Bill Kunstler, used to say there are no green pastures, that every generation has its own struggles. And this exhibit shows that, the struggles for generations going all the way back to 1215.
Well, thank you. And if there's anything, any final words you want to give our listeners?
Oh, just one quick thing, if we might add, is that once again, we will continue the exhibit, The Foundations of Freedom, after the 15th. So the message will still be here, and most of the display will still be here. The Magna Carta itself will, of course, be on its way back to England. But if you can't make it here by the 15th and you're still interested in the content of this exhibit, and by the way, all the other wonderful permanent exhibits we have here, like the Long Room where George Washington bade farewell to his officers, as you mentioned, Michael, those are ongoing all year round.
Okay, now I'm going to give you a person we've interviewed, Peter Linbob's book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, which talks about the Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest. It's quite an interesting book on sort of his view about reviving some of what it says. Anyway, you'll enjoy it. It's not the easiest read, but you'll like it.
He's a great historian. Yeah. It's a really interesting book.
The Magna Carta Manifesto. What's extraordinary about this book is how it changes how we think about the Magna Carta. When you mention Magna Carta, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Guild, all of us, think about political freedoms, the right to be free from torture, the right to be free from arbitrary detention, the Guantanamo detainees, all those basic rights that King John was forced to give up at Runnymede in the year 1215 when the nobles really confronted him, but it also meant a lot of rights for the people. One of the things Peter's new book does is it puts that struggle, and it was a struggle, it didn't just happen, in an historical context, but it brings up another charter that was like a companion to the Magna Carta called the Charter of the Forest. And what the Charter of the Forest did was talk about fundamental economic rights and how that people not only had the right not to be put in jail just by the king's word, but they also had a right to essentially a baseline of being able to live and exist, which meant they had a right to the commons, the right to the forest, the right to put their pig in the forest, the right to graze their animals, and that a lot of property was seen as the commons belonging to the public. And what has happened, obviously, since 1215 has not only been, particularly in the current period, the suppression of political rights, but obviously the complete removal from our history or of this tradition of struggle over fundamental economic rights. And what Peter Linbob's book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, does, and why it's so critical to today, is it brings back the issue and the importance of fundamental economic rights, rights that many of us think are necessary for anyone to be able to exercise other kinds of political rights from the First Amendment on. Today, we're really pleased to have really a pioneering author, Peter Linbob, who will talk to us about his new book, Magna Carta Manifesto.
Peter, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
I'm really pleased to have you here. You know, Peter, I've followed your work for a long time. I've read some of your earlier books, London Hanged and some others, which we'll talk about. But the book you're coming out with this week, with the Magna Carta Manifesto, is to me really in some ways one of the most important books you've come out with. And I know I've followed, you know, from my point of view, of course, the Magna Carta, from the work I do on Guantanamo, is, you know, the fundamental charter of human liberty in the sense of what we call civil rights or the right not to be arrested without a trial, etc. But there's another part of the Magna Carta that I think this book talks about. What are you doing with the Magna Carta, and what does it really represent to you as we look at our world today?
My work on the Magna Carta began with the crisis, the constitutional crisis of the preemptive endless war on terror after 2001. The subtitle of my book is called Liberties and Commons for All. And the liberties part, we're all very well aware of how they've been taken away, whether it's at Guantanamo or Afghanistan or people in New Orleans or Baghdad. The commons part, commons for all, we're less accustomed to seeing in Magna Carta. And yet Magna Carta is full of safeguards against privatizers, against those who would take common property or the results of common neighborhood human labor and privatize it for their own profit. And this is an essential part of Magna Carta, and it's an essential part of our world today, as from Sumatra to Chiapas, from Asia, South America, to the native people of our own country.
Well, I mean, I guess the most graphic example, and I guess there's many that you're going to give, but in the 1500s, it was about common rights to the forest or to the deer or whatever. And today it might be about common rights to the oil wealth of a country or other kinds of common rights. And what's interesting to me, of course, is that when we learn about the Magna Carta in school, is we never really talk about what are property rights or really the rights of the public or the commons to share in the wealth of the country. It's always about civil and political rights, the right to free speech, et cetera, which, while important, are not the only rights we're talking about. And without sort of a fundamental base in the economic structure, they're not that meaningful.
Right. This is what I found when I began studying Magna Carta. It was on the 11th of September, 1217, after the 1215 document was lost and civil war had resumed. It was found again on that date and produced with a smaller charter called the Charter of the Forest. And it did exactly what you just described. It was forms of protection of subsistence rights for people to the woodlands. And in that epoch of history, more so than our own, the woods was the form that hydrocarbon energy took. And so there's an exact parallel, not just a chemical parallel, but a historical and social parallel between the protection of the woodlands for all back then and the protection and our own oil economy.
You know, what's interesting about that division between what we call the Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest, which in some way you could broadly, I'm not sure I'm right, but divides civil and political rights from economic and maybe social rights. It's the same division that you see in United Nations documents and treaties today. We have a treaty on political and civil rights, and we have another treaty on economic and social rights. And of course, in this country, all of our human rights organizations, or almost all of them, are familiar with enforcing political and civil rights, but getting economic and social rights enforced is essentially a zero. I mean, it's not that we just don't want to do it. It's just that it's nothing you can do with it in the courts. They just don't want to go there. So one of the reasons I think your work is so critical is it's really reviving where the origins of those rights are.
Right. And I went to look at that division in the late 1940s. What I learned there was that it was the great American, African-American W.E.B. Du Bois who attacked that separation of rights of the stomach, so to speak, from rights of speech, or from civil and political rights on the one hand, from economic rights on the other. Du Bois argued with Eleanor Roosevelt, and he argued at Bretton Woods for on behalf of the millions of people of the Third World, the people of color, who had been excluded from this post-war deal.
I learned from the great historian Harvey Goldberg, who was my professor at Wisconsin, that the ideology of private property really crashed asunder these rights we're talking about, and that with John Locke and the bourgeois revolutions in the 17th and 18th century, the idea that private property was just a social construct and could be set aside for the common good was wrecked. And after that, you had the kind of avarice, you know, just uncontrolled capitalism that we have today. And he took it all the way back to the 17th and 18th century.
Right. And I take it back even earlier than that. I go to Shakespeare's time, and I go before that as well, back to the 13th century when Magna Carta was promulgated. And I think it's important for us in America, our education emphasizes John Locke. And what we forget is that John Locke was answering a very powerful thinker, Jared Winstanley. And it was Winstanley who said that the earth belonged to no one, that it was a common treasury for all. Winstanley was part of the levelers of the English Civil War. And it was these people who John Locke was really frightened of. And so he developed his notions of private property in contrast to them.
I know the book is going to take us back through the history of this. Can you just tell us something about the focus of the book? It's going to go back through the history, but is it also going to go forward till today? And what lessons in terms of thinking about our political work today will it give us?
I've been thinking about this, and the lessons for us today, I think, depends on a kind of creativity and widespread discussion that we haven't had yet. And that's a discussion that must occur in the grassroots. I think as you look through history, you know that the ruling class is able to retain its avaricious powers only to the extent that it keeps us apart, that it keeps the others apart. And we're familiar with gender and racial divisions, but also they have to throw us together in some circumstances, you know, whether it's in the emergency of flood or earthquake, or whether it's their own deeds that have turned our own country into basically a prison, a carceral continent we've become. And then people get together and we begin talking. We learn that so much in our history has been stolen from us, whether it's our land or whether it's our cities or whether it's our wealth. And we have a commoning past ourselves that goes to Frederick Douglass or to Jane Addams or John L. Lewis. And we must recover that knowledge of our own commoning in contrast to the dominant narrative of American history, which is one of the triumph of capitalism, the triumph of private property, the triumph of consumer society, and a constitutional discussion that sees it, the Constitution not just as a matter of government, but a matter of social and economic order or of security for all is going to require us to do some deep thinking. It's in the belief of the necessity of that I wrote this book about the Magna Carta and why I call it a manifesto, because it manifests or brings to our attention some things that we used to think were racial or conservative, like the English Magna Carta. But when you look at them, there is a history of English-speaking workers around the world that haven't bowed down, haven't bent their backs to the burden and the weight of the oppressors. It's in this belief that we need to have a deeper constitutional discussion than just a matter of government, but a matter of what constitutes our society.
For those who've just tuned in to Law and Disorder, we're speaking with Peter Linebaugh about his wonderful new book, Magna Carta Manifesto, subtitled Liberties and Commons for All. And Peter, I wanted to ask you to address yourself to the three main things that I remember from a civics class that came out of that document from the year 1215. Habeas corpus, of course, and trial by jury, and the right not to be tortured. Can you tell us about how that came up in that document and where things stand today in your view?
Sure. Well, it comes up in Chapter 39. Chapter 39 of Magna Carta used to be part of a Latin that school children had to learn, and it's engraved in many of the older courthouses of the United States. Chapter 39, that you can't be deprived or you can't be imprisoned, you can't be destroyed without judgment by your peers and due process of law. And where it stands today, I think you have been world exemplars in the struggle to revive them, to keep them alive against the destruction of habeas corpus, against the widespread use of torture, against the unaccounted, unchecked imprisonments. And really, my hat's off to the people who are litigating and defending those in Guantanamo Bay.
You know, Peter, I want to address that for a second, because I feel, you know, really strongly, obviously, about the torture issues in Guantanamo. And yet at the same time, I realize that what's really lacking in this country is any awareness of what you're trying to say in this book and what economic rights mean and what it means to have a good education and good health care and to share the commons. And I do think even in our work here at, you know, in New York or in civil liberties groups around the country, that's really a perspective that's lacking. And when you see that a billion people in the world basically have some money and 5 billion don't, you just think about how your work is crucial and the perspective that it has to bring, really, to the work of people in the United States.
Yeah, we have. When I say we need to learn our history, I mean we, you know, we just celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday last week. And this is a man who spoke against materialism, who spoke against imperialism, and who spoke against racism as the three sources of oppression.
What he called the triplets.
Exactly, exactly, the three-headed triplet.
Right.
That's right. And he sought a battering ram that could bring these down. And Frederick Douglass had said the Magna Carta was such a battering ram. And if I can just quote another part of Magna Carta that I think goes directly to your question, and that is from its Chapter 7, which says, "She shall have in the meantime her reasonable estovers in the common." And this puts forth, you know, a notion of material life that's not just devil take the hindmost. It's not that competitive society which leads to the capitalist classes that we're so familiar with, where the security of a tiny number of people is purchased at the insecurity of millions of people all around our planet. And it's that job that Magna Carta calls on us, or Magna Carta is there to help us do, you know, if we want to do that.
Now, you mentioned the word estover. I remember reading a draft of your book and wondering about what does that word mean. So can you just go through that quote again and just say something about estover?
Yeah. Estover is a medieval term. Edward Cook explained its meaning. He was a jurist who was the teacher, so to speak, of Blackstone and the American founding fathers. Estovers, he explained, was the right to go to the woodlands to collect wood for nurturance. It would depend on the locale, how much wood you could take out, for precisely what purpose it would be used for food, for tools, for fuel, for cooking. These would be some of the uses. So estovers referred to that right among the commoners. And the commoners would be the poor people of any particular locale.
And Peter, do you go into the driving off the land, the privatization of the commons, and the formation of the working class where they were forced into the cities and forced into these 16-hour-a-day jobs and really not part of nature anymore, not part of any kind of collective society, but really just like wage slaves? How does that coincide with the loss of these rights under Magna Carta?
Yeah, that's a deep question, because a deal was made, I think, in the 1830s and 1840s among the English working class. Remember, that's a time of the anti-slavery movement in the Americas. But in the English working class said, if you're going to drive us into the factories, you must provide us with the wherewithal that you've just stolen from us. In other words, we've lost our commons. We've lost the ability to put a pig in the forest or to graze a sheep or to collect wood. And in return, we insist upon having economic rights. We insist upon. So money was regarded or became part of the working class demand for subsistence. And I think it remained that way, you know, right through the American New Deal, right through the welfare program in Great Britain during World War II, you know, with the cradle to the grave welfare policy. But in our own era, welfare, we've lost both. We've lost both our commons, and we've lost the money that we were supposed to have in return for that loss. Now, I think more than ever, we have to return to perhaps the fundamental part of Magna Carta, which Tom Paine pointed out in Common Sense, which is the right of resistance. We have to begin our constitutional discussion of reconstituting our society while resisting the present expropriators, if I can use the term of those who take away common rights, who privatize for their personal gain the wealth that used to belong to the public or belong to our class or belongs to the commoners.
That's where your discussion really of oil is so interesting to me because, you know, obviously most of the oil countries in the world, because once you can control oil, you just don't need to develop anything else in the country and you don't, and it can be privatized, et cetera, is obviously a crucial issue. And in that context, I look at Iraq and Venezuela. And when the U.S. went into Iraq, obviously the new oil deal is essentially going to be to privatize oil again in Iraq and take it away even from the state, essentially, more or less. Whereas in Venezuela, you have a situation where there's actually oil wealth that is looked at as part of the patrimony of the people, at least broadly. I don't know if that's what you think, but that's at least my sort of broad take on it.
Yes, I think so, too. And I would add to that Nigeria or, you know, other parts of the oil-producing regions of the world.
Nigeria in what sense?
Where there, too, the big oil companies, formerly the Seven Sisters, have divided up the offshore waters for drilling rights. And many commoners, you remember Ken Sarawiwa, for example.
Well, the center represents him and his family. He was actually murdered.
Uh-huh. Right. They were defending commoners in the mangrove commons along the delta against the pollution, against the prostitution, against the depredations of the big oil companies.
Listeners, we've been speaking with really one of the great professors in the country, Peter Linebaugh, who has written Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. Peter Linebaugh, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And
bye-bye.
Really, it's terrific pioneering work, and I really appreciate it.